The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Maybe we call this not the blue wave, but the green wave, because that is our currency color. But the cost of security, we've learned from history, the cost of security is freedom. And what we're learning in terms of the market is that the cost of predictability, it's in the stability of our currency. So whether it's a blue wave or an orange wave, it's still the Fed tsunami I worry about most.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, David, something fun to do every once in a while is just go walk outside in a group of people and start looking up. And what you'll find is a second person, then a third person will look up. And before long, everyone is looking up. Now, there may not be anything to see, but it's human nature. If someone thinks they see something in the sky or if you see somebody looking up.
What are you looking at?
Yeah. What are you looking at?
I want to know.
You know what it reminds me of? It seems just like the Federal Reserve. They start talking about things, not about the past, not about the present, but they start acting as if they know what the future is. What in the heck is this blue wave? Is it just all the mainstream media looking up at the same time, hoping that everybody else does?
Well, do you see it? I think I see it.
I don't know that I see the blue wave they're telling me.
While the blue wave is quickly becoming what the news media prints as an inevitability, and I think it's wishful thinking, most often, it's repeated by those outlets that want to speak reality into existence.
Right.
So this is what's going to happen. We're going to have a clean sweep of the Senate. We're going to have Biden and Kamala as president and vice president.
It reminds me a little bit of when you're looking at financial technical charts, a lot of times you're also looking forward in time and you wonder if it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. I mean, I think to talk about the blue wave is to sort of create a sense of inevitability. And there was some aspects of that in 2016 where there was just this energy coming into the election. And well, it ended up being a little bit different than everyone anticipated. Real surprise. And To be honest, I prefer the Elliott wave to the blue wave.
Right.
I mean, it's where you're looking at the probabilities of upside and downside. And you're looking at charts and numbers and stripping away some of the political aspects. And, you know, if the Dow closes above 29,174, Robert Prechter says the probability of a rise into 2021 will increase substantially. On the downside, the most important level is 27,773 on the Dow, or the corresponding number for the S&P 500 would be 3,361. These are the lows set Tuesday, October the 6th, and you break below them, and it's kind of gatey by the door. Watch out below.
And just for clarity, for the person who doesn't watch the news, good for you. And for the person who doesn't have internet, maybe good for you too. The blue wave is really just referring to a Democrat sweep at this point.
Yeah, politics is too often an expression of self-interest and frankly, an expression of tribal desire. And in an age of fake news and sort of twisted narratives from both the right and the left, what's published may have little to do with reality and more about desire.
What we want to have happen or what the media wants to have happen.
Yeah, what you want to be versus what truly is. And you'll find that your proclivity towards, you know, the news outlet that you want to watch kind of reflects your desire. So on that point, we are going to be inviting a philosophy professor. Imagine that. To be a guest on the program and discuss fake news with us. And this is not from the standpoint of deciding who's right or wrong, but from the standpoint of epistemology. Epistemology is one of the four areas of philosophy, along with metaphysics, ethics, and logic. And epistemology is that part that asks, how do we know what we know? And how do we come to believe something as true? So just in time for the election, this book, which is titled Beyond Fake News, Finding the Truth in a World of Misinformation, written by Justin McBrayer, published by Routledge, I think it'll help cut through some of our misconceptions about knowledge, some of our conceptions about truth, and of course, help us see perhaps the 24-hour news cycle a little differently.
I think that's something that's really changed over the last 10 years. It has been this rise of fake news. And, you know, what it can do is it can inspire either massive depression or it can inspire excessive optimism, you know, and I think more of the markets than I think of politics, because everything in politics right now, I think, is depressing. But on the market front, you seem to have excessive optimism.
You know, I think one of the things I would say about that is this iteration of fake news and this particular time frame, it feels different. But I felt the same way when I was looking at how there was sort of character assassination in the news media. And it took going back and reading the Hamilton biography to realize that the news media was just as salacious and cruel hundreds of years ago. And they would absolutely, I mean, if there was political gain to be had, they had no qualms with dragging a man or a woman through the mud and sort of tarring and feathering them. Whether it was true or not did not matter. It did not matter. There was a political gain and an advantage that was being sought.
So nothing new under the sun?
Not really.
Fake news.
We just have a different moniker for it. We call it something slightly different. So there's some talk of the wisdom of the markets, and I tend to want to periodically ask about the wisdom of the markets when what is on display seems to me more akin to a frat party than sort of the gathering of all the sage-like personas.
Everybody's looking up for no reason. Right. Maybe because they're drunk.
Maybe. So, I mean, having a group of people all headed the same direction at the same time doesn't define anything. But in the case of a frat party, what you could describe as beer goggle judgment. Mm. Right. So, I won't admit to this, but the world in all its complexity becomes very clear after a six pack. And, you know, the many join the one. There's a transformation occurs where any girl becomes the most beautiful girl. Beauty emerges somewhere after 4, 5, or 6 beers.
So, well, there's difference liquidity-wise, though. Okay, liquidity of beer is something that will cloud the judgment. But liquidity of money actually does the same thing, doesn't it?
So can we first ask, when we're looking at sort of the wisdom of the markets and this collective judgment, are the markets reflecting excess liquidity? Is this a sober-minded judgment, or is this the inebriated judgment? And so, you know, with that, does Biden look that good through beer goggles? I don't think so. Does Trump, for that matter, look that good through beer goggles? I don't think so. And so, I mean, what is the market getting enthusiastic about? Coming back to this notion of a blue wave.
Yeah.
Because can the market really be enthusiastic about Comrade Kamala for president after Pelosi floating the 25th Amendment balloon?
Wasn't that interesting? It's interesting. I think they're sensing the blue wave, or they're hoping for the blue wave as well, because they're already setting things up for Biden not even to be there.
Right. So, I mean, again, so is that what we see, or is it really not a blue wave at all? Are we talking about a monetary tsunami?
Did you see what people said when they were polled, when they actually polled African Americans about Kamala Harris?
That was the Rasmussen poll of people likely to vote Democrat because of Kamala Harris, or less likely. And it was equal on both sides. 32% on both sides. 32% said less likely to vote because she's on the ticket. Equal to the number of people who said more likely. It was fascinating.
So there's a battle of waves that you're talking about. You know, you bring up the blue wave, which is this supposed Democrat sweep, but actually the wave that really is coming and the wave that actually has begun is a monetary wave, is it not?
Yeah, because of course I don't know who wins, but the obvious wave to me is the monetary tsunami that continues to pour over every asset class, and it's defining pricing insanity. It's not the sober and wise judgment of the market. To me, it's collective amnesia on bubble dynamics. It's collective risk-taking due to the explicit Fed support of asset prices. And that's what it is, plain and simple. It's not some sort of a read into the future and who wins and what are the ramifications. Yeah, because again, the mainstream media is fond of attribution. And in many senses, it's sort of a causal type thing. You get this on CNBC or Bloomberg all the time. Something happens. You have, you know, 25-cent move in a particular stock. And the pundit is out there to say, well, it's doing that because. And there is no dot to connect. They just have to have something to say.
They got to keep you entertained.
That's
not fake news.
And so it must be a Biden victory and Senate sweep that's driving the markets to new heights. I think this is the Fed wave.
Yeah.
It's the free money wave. It's not the blue wave. It's not the orange wave.
So the truth of the matter is, actually, people are casting their votes right now in the market for the Fed. It really, it's not a presidential vote right now at all. It's a money vote toward markets and excess liquidity.
Precisely. When you're looking at the financial markets, it reflects financial conditions. That's it. We live in a period of excess risk taking where optimism is not reflective of economic anticipations. What we have sort of in the works in terms of the economy, it's not reflective of the social mood in general, which frankly today is very contentious, very angry, even to some degree scared. And it's not reflective of who's going to win or not win the elections. The mainstream media actually on that point has been pretty poor in sort of gauging outcomes.
It really makes you wonder if we actually had good news that the economy was going to recover on its own and it was time for the Fed to step aside and let the market do what it does and let the economy do what it does. I would imagine the market would go down.
To me, you look at market optimism in the present. And what it really reflects is the market's response to those outsized measures that central planners have taken.
Desperate measures.
So on the one hand, you have market optimism. On the other hand, it's the desperate measures of central planners spending trillions and trillions of dollars to keep spirits high for fear of a systemic reset. I mean, you don't have to go back very far. March of this year and, you know, punctuated just about once a year for several years of the market getting ready to collapse and being in the process of a complete systemic unwind. And then comes the policy measures which hold it all together.
Like the promise of free money, the promise of low interest rates, the promise of continuing the way we have.
And the problem is it's not a structural prop. I mean, we're talking about chewing gum and baling wire. And while I appreciate sort of the MacGyver nature of duct tape, you don't want to take a $20 trillion economy and assume that we can move forward on some sort of high-powered duct tape. So we are, in fact, courting disaster in the financial markets. This week, you had retired Goldman frontman, CEO Lloyd Blankfein. He was talking on CNBC, and he says, look, low interest rates are like free money for big institutional investors. So when you lower interest rates, you flow the capital to the guys that can get it and leverage it, and free money creates bubble-like dynamics. That was his whole theme on the CNBC interview. And that's what he sees in the market is bubble-like dynamics, too much risk-taking, not enough verification, not enough business plan analysis. He started poking at the SPACs, the special purpose acquisition companies, which are just one of the many bubble dynamics on display at which he was referencing.
Yeah, on the SPACs, I think it's worth talking about a little bit because what we're seeing is very similar to what we saw back about 20 years ago, 22 years ago with the dot-com bubble, where it really didn't matter what the investment was. As long as it had dot-com behind it, people would just throw money at it. The SPACs are like that. Would you explain just a little bit to the listener this new development where money's flowing to things that really don't even have to define themselves?
Yeah, I mean, you generally think of an IPO as a company going public. In this case, it's going public and we'll tell you what the company is after we've raised the money for it. A special purpose acquisition company means you're going to give us a couple $100 million and then we're going to put it to work and we'll figure out on the basis of our reputation and connections what to do. So, you know, you get Paul Ryan involved with one of those SPACs now. Just about everybody's involved in a SPAC somewhere, somehow.
So it's the liquidity. It's the liquidity, stupid. You know, they used to say it's the economy, stupid, but it's really the liquidity, stupid.
It's
right
the
now.
Liquidity, stupid. To go public, you don't even need a company.
Right.
Does that tell you anything about the excess nature of credit in the system?
So this isn't hope for a blue wave. What we're seeing is not hope for a blue wave. It's actually just saying we've got this monetary wave.
Right. Well, again, Blankfein's like, big institutional investors love this. Low interest rates are free money. So yes, the defining factor in the market, it's not the hope of a blue wave. It's the fiscal and monetary largesse in the case of either the blue shirts or the red shirts winning. Because think about it. Big institutional investors can get along fine. They've flourished in the context of a Democratic administration. They've flourished in the context of a Republican administration.
And now interest rates are zero.
They want to know
they
one
thing. They want free
thing.
Money. Yeah.
Will the liquidity tap remain on, or will the liquidity tap be turned off? That's the only thing that matters to the leveraged speculative community, the big institutional investors Blankfein was talking about.
And money doesn't cost anything. Not right now. Not to the big institutions.
So put interest rates to near zero, promise to spend trillions to keep them low, maintain an air of crisis related to COVID. Again, it legitimizes any action, whether it's a public policy action or a monetary policy action or fiscal policy. And it gives you carte blanche, permissions to spend any amount necessary from the Treasury. And of course, the Fed would act as guarantor, you know, purchaser of first and last resort. And it's a very interesting dynamic. But if there's a problem in the system, you name the asset, the Fed names the price.
When we were kids, we would play musical chairs. Remember when you were in school, you'd play musical chairs. And at some point, the music stops and there wasn't enough chairs. And that's the whole deal. But we've been playing musical chairs now for longer than anybody can remember. And the music has not stopped. It's just gotten louder and louder and louder. I wonder if these speculative investors wonder if it'll ever happen.
Well, we've talked so often about the presumption of control and this idea that, you know, somehow, whether it's Powell under the Trump administration or Bernanke under the Obama administration, they're going to make just the right choice at just the right time to keep these things from happening. And yet, look at the debacles that we've had in 20 years and the frequency of those significant financial market ruptures, right? And, you know, is Trump going to do less than the Democrats from a fiscal standpoint? No. Are the red shirts somehow fiscally conservative? I mean, look, if you're still in that small cadre of naive people that thinks that they are, just check the record. Are the blue shirts afraid of spending someone else's money or running deficits to spend on pet projects themselves? No, no. Our two-party system is in many respects a one-party system.
Right. And it always involves other people's money.
Sure. But you have different characters in the cast. They compete for control of the narrative. But the act ends roughly the same. And by the way, there doesn't end up being the amount of control that is broadcast. There's, again, it's not as if Jerome Powell is actually capable of suspending the sun, moon, and stars. He's not gravity, anti-gravity. He doesn't have some supernatural powers, right? I mean, even though you might see him on a Time magazine wearing a cape, not actually a superhero. He's just a good guy.
But he can print money. And, you know, the municipalities cannot print money. So you've got to have, at some point, a day of reckoning for those who are spending in deficit, knowing they can't pay it back, and they can't print the money to pay it.
Well, this comes back to that fiscal conversation. Is it 1.5? Is it 1.8? Is it 2.2? Is it 2.4? And the difference in packages being offered does come down to who's going to support the municipalities. Only the municipalities need to be worried about the money not coming through. But frankly, I mean, if you want to do point and counterpoint on that, you've got an open checkbook. The Fed can move to backstop municipalities. They can remove any of the stress or fretting that might exist amongst fixed income investors. And I mean, again, it's important to remember that the Fed's economic projections assumed another fiscal stimulus. It's going to come.
Just watching the Democrats and the Republicans compete for how much money they can spend on this stimulus package shows that it is just one party. You know, if you were to actually see a party exercise discipline, it would probably disgust the people. They wouldn't be happy about it. They'd be like, what are you talking about? Monetary discipline at this point?
Yeah. You had in the 2018 elections, you had 31 seats that moved, and those seats are vulnerable coming into this election if you don't see the money flow. And the Democrats are keenly aware of that. So will there be something that emerges before the election? I think so, because you're actually talking about constituents between a rock and a hard place in at least 31 locations. So, yeah, I mean, blue wave, I think there's a lot more that is uncertain about the political outcomes and may serve as a radical surprise. And to the degree that Wall Street starts lining up in favor of a blue wave, they may find actually that they lined up on one side of the boat. And that is of great consequence, regardless of how you feel about politics. Anytime you're in the marketplace, lining up on one side of the boat is highly consequential.
So any display of discipline whatsoever would have huge consequences at this point.
Yeah. And, you know, we talked about last week being in an age of excess and, you know, there being sort of disgust with the idea of scarcity, almost turning up the nose, a disdain for limits. You don't have enough imagination. If you haven't come into the fold in terms of modern monetary theory and what can be done with pro forma budgetary math, you know, you just don't understand. You just don't get it.
Well, with all this excess liquidity, the markets sort of are acting like all is well, but there's an indicator there, Dave, that you like to watch that's saying not everybody thinks that way, or at least they're hedging their bet.
Well, and to the degree that you have liquidity available, you don't have companies or specific, like we talked about credit default swaps in the past, that can be an indicator of things that are deteriorating as liquidity is tightening. But what do you do in a context where liquidity is not tightening? Liquidity is flowing freely, and yet you have these aberrant indicators like the VIX. The VIX is remaining stubbornly high. This is how you measure the ratio between people buying puts and calls.
Okay. So betting up or down.
Yeah. And this is, you know, more or less a leveraged speculative bet, either on the long side or the short side. People tend to buy puts to hedge a position or to speculate on the downside. But that number has not dropped below 25 since August 31st.
So that indicates that some people are putting the market at this point or betting down.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's an aberrant thing because the whole world is quote unquote risk on at this point. But the VIX indicates that someone, and it's likely your big institutional investors, someone playing with massive dollars leveraged to the hilt is still buying the whoops insurance.
Mm.
You know, whoops, we got it wrong. Whoops, we were a little overextended. Or whoops, the central planners couldn't keep it together as tightly as advertised, as much as they broadcast. Whoops, it was actually a confidence game, and now we're on the slide side. So insurance in the form of options, still very expensive. And that's kind of the singular point where you'd say everyone is full throttle, we're going to be fine, except Vic says, still hedging a bet, at least a little bit.
You know, the weather's still nice here in Durango, and I see you ride the bike in. You've got your motorcycle. And I do notice that you still put leather on, even though you say you're a safe you're a safe motorcycle driver. The leather still needs to be there, doesn't it? And that's the IPS insurance.
It is the whoops insurance because it's not just you that can make a mistake. It's someone else who could be a distracted driver or whatever else. And I think, you know, when we speak of a slide, my kids often hear me say, because I do have a motorcycle, you dress for the slide, not the ride. Because everybody goes down at some point. And the question is, do you ride with all your faculties engaged? Do you assume general safety? And you can't on two wheels. You should assume a war zone is out there. Mm. And so you dress for the slide, not the ride. And the markets are actually dressed for the ride, not the slide. And it makes for a very messy cleanup when something goes wrong. March comes to mind. That was the most recent, guess we were dressed the wrong way. We live in a college town, and every year I see some 18-year-old with an underdeveloped cerebral cortex flying around on a motorbike. And they're in shorts, they're in a t-shirt. I even saw a guy in flip-flops once. And of course, you've got sunglasses for eye protection, but no helmet, no gloves, no leather jacket. And the ride is glorious as long as everything goes right.
And you brought out that they were 18 years old, because if they were 20 or 22 or 25 or 30, there's a point, like you said, everybody goes down. We all learn from experience. In fact, sometimes that's the very best thing that can happen to you young, is to live through something that might kill you later. You just sort of change. But, you know, let's go back to the musical chairs thing and the 18-year-old riding the motorcycle. If the 18-year-old has never gone down, but he's got that engine beneath him, okay, he's really, at some point, going to either learn the hard way or never even make it through. Musical chairs is the same thing. We were talking about the music not stopping, just getting louder and louder and louder. And it seems to me that the current confidence in the financial markets is trained. Remember when we read Gonzalez's book, Deep Survival? He talked about if you repeat something that's very dangerous without the consequence, you start to believe that that will be the way it always is. That's human nature. The problem is that day is coming when you'll learn differently.
Yep. You normalize the danger and it becomes something that you underestimate. You know, and I think this is what Lloyd was getting at in the CNBC interview, because he's basically saying you put free money into the market and the decisions that you make are different. You husband the resource differently when you have infinite access. That was his word. You husband differently. Of course you do. And so, yes, there's current confidence in the financial markets. And nothing bad happened last time. I mean, you know, how quickly do we move on from March 2020? It was a mere aberration on the path to what do we have now? You know, millions or billions or trillions. And that's the path towards the American dream. But I think one of the issues as we come to November is there's not too many people on that path. And that factor, more than any other, defined the 2016 election and the surprise that many people experienced. Let's call them the educated folk who first woke, a different kind of woke, but they woke up to an election outcome that they thought this isn't even possible.
So let's talk about election outcomes that I don't know that everybody's thought through. Okay, Harris, Biden, okay, and I put that in order the way I meant to. Harris, Biden, Amendment 25.
Yeah. Well, the blue wave theory conveniently sets aside the reality of a Harris-Biden vendetta. I mean, not only raising capital gains, tax rates, but also corporate income taxes. So you've got the first, which is a hit to investor motivations and could certainly precipitate sort of a post-election, pre-January 1st sell-off in the market.
What does that do to interest rates, which have been unusually low in fueling this thing?
Well, I think very critically is that second point, which is corporate earnings, which would definitely come under the gun with an increase in income taxes. And that, I think, factors in not just as an end-of-year event, sort of, you know, between November whatever, because we don't have a specific date that we'll know who's president, and the inauguration.
So they'd be targeted with earnings. And at that point, again, my question, interest rates.
Yeah, Financial Times says this week that a blue sweep brings forward a rise in interest rates by at least 2 years. And I read that and I thought about it and I kicked it around and I thought, you know, as if the financial structure that the world central banks have built could actually take the strain of increasing interest rates. So we have the inflation, which they expect to run a little hot, and we've already adjusted expectations there, changed the policy, right? So that's what Wall Street bakes into the blue wave cake, is a little bit more inflation, and on that basis, probably a sooner time frame to an increase in interest rates. But again, look at the backdrop. I mean, it's not like $27 trillion is inconsequential, and that's just federal debt. We're not talking about corporate or household debt. The Fed starts a tightening cycle 2 years ahead of schedule?
Can that even happen?
Please. I don't think so, because you're talking about a voluntary tightening of financial conditions. Can you see a non-voluntary tightening of financial conditions? Yes. But a voluntary tightening where it's orchestrated by the Fed, we could call that the Floyd effect. At least that's the way it would be experienced for the leveraged speculator. Not going to happen. They can't breathe.
Going back to 2016, we looked at the polls, we heard the polls, we talked about it on the commentary, and the polls just turned out to be plain wrong. I mean, plain wrong. Talk about a surprise. It's like, wait a second, you know, are the polls themselves fake news?
Yeah, I think it's wishful thinking by, and I want to say, please don't take this as critical, but there's a lot of emotional desperation. You know, there's a sort of a channeling of inner political disgust. Again, you go back to 2016 and the shock that this is not my America, right? That was the words that I heard from a lot of people. And, you know, the polls suggested that Hillary was ahead by 10 points, 12 points, 14 points. And that was everything from ABC, CBS, NBC, Rasmussen, Gallup. I mean, it was like a grand sweep. And again, I think we've forgotten how wrong the polls were coming into the 2016 election.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Biden's not going to garner, he's different. He's not going to garner the same levels of dislike that Clinton did, Hillary. But it has to be noted, almost all of your elections, almost all of your election outcomes have been informed, I wouldn't say determined, but have been informed by how a candidate does in the early stages of the primaries. And so if you look at how Biden did in the early stages of the primaries. If you look at how Harris did in the early stages of the primaries, they performed abysmally. The DNC basically stepped in, chose Biden, and worked through to get him placed. I think this is typical. The DNC coming from a position of arrogance and sort of disconnectedness from their constituencies. You know, frankly, if you look at Democrats in the hinterland, they wanted a different kind of leadership for a long time.
You wonder if they even feel orphaned at this point, you know, because there are probably a lot of Democrats out there that are offended that they're being compared to communists.
Well, and you have that expression of discontent within the Democrats that are searching for an identity. The AOC, Bernie Sanders, sort of let it burn theory of progress. But I'm thinking more of, when you say orphaned, what comes to mind is the blue collar guy or gal out there, the blue dog Democrats that are a little bit more fiscally conservative. And what are they turned off by? They're turned off by insider politics, elitism, lack of constraints, and identity politics, frankly, which are beyond the pale, even for many Democrats.
So, what do you think they thought about what Putin said about their own party?
I thought it was fascinating because he wasn't, well, I mean, he was talking about Biden, right? I couldn't believe it from Newsweek of all people, that saying that Putin wants to work with Biden, claiming shared values between the Democrats and the communists.
He's not that far off.
Well, maybe not if he's talking about the extractive opportunism in the Ukraine. But that's, again, more of a Biden issue, not necessarily broadly Democrat issue. There are some similarities between those two. As much as similarities or symmetries have been drawn between Trump and Putin, it appears that when Putin looks in the mirror, he kind of fancies Biden.
So do you think a lot of these voters are going to go in and just say, I don't care? I just am voting no for Trump.
I think that's your best case scenario, is a no Trump vote. And that's very different, isn't it, from a yes to some sort of visional leadership? It's a reluctant vote. It's not an enthusiastic vote. It's you've got to do your duty and be loyal to the party on this one because you don't love, you certainly don't like the alternative. So, you know, what does Biden have? He's not campaigning on the economy.
Well, can he? I mean, Americans still feel they're better off than they were 4 years ago.
Right. Clinton was able to come in and say, look, it's the economy, stupid. That was the message in the early 90s.
That was Bill Clinton. Yeah.
Yep. The first in the dynasty. Last week, you had Gallup surveys, which concluded 56% of Americans still say, this is last week, still say they're better off now than 4 years ago. And that is, just for historical reference points, that's 12 points higher. At 56, that's 12 points higher than a similar poll taken by Gallup when Reagan won 49 states.
Hmm.
It's
hmm.
10 points higher than when Obama was reelected, right? So he can't run on the economy. And they've tried. And actually, the whole closure thing with COVID, I think, was a veiled attempt to basically be able to make the argument and make it about economics.
Well, and running on centrist views. Remember when there was this whole talk of a third way where, no, we're not Democrat, we're not Republican, we're centrist, we're everything.
That was, again, going back to the 90s, Clinton's big thing, Bill. The third way socialism focused on something palatable to everybody who was a little bit closer to the middle. And, you know,
sort of the John McCain's of the world.
Yeah. if you want a Republican version of it. Yeah. So Biden brings, he doesn't bring the hope mantra so persuasively and somewhat ambiguously pitched by Obama. In that context, on the Obama ticket, Biden was an afterthought. As a VP. I mean, what did he bring to the table? The change mandate? I mean, what represented change was the first African-American president. That was understood as getting on the right side of history, right? Biden as VP was sort of an associated accident of that history where, you know, you've got a career politician who needs to be matched up with the junior senator from Illinois, you know, who really didn't have that much experience, right? So the surprise in 2016... The surprise in 2016 was hidden in plain sight.
Hmm.
Change, not the Obama change of 2008, but the change defined in 2016 was defined in the Rust Belt. And it was defined by the submerging middle class because they're desperate for an improved lot in life.
So this blue wave that the mainstream media is talking about is really just me looking up and getting other people to look up. They're looking up and trying to show you something that isn't there.
Narrative management, mainstream media is all about it, creating the impression of reality and hoping that it becomes a reality. And this is not unlike what the Fed does to control, and apparently the Fed doesn't have a monopoly on narrative management, but it's going to be okay is the Fed's ploy. We've got this under control is the Fed's ploy. We're going to tell you we can see the future when we don't have a crystal ball, but you're going to believe us anyways. And you let it become reality. I think the blue wave, this is something of a political ploy being processed through that 24-hour news cycle.
So we've only been talking about the executive branch, but there are two other branches of our government, and one of those branches right now is highly unfavorable, according to the polls.
Yeah, well, you've got the very hot discussion about the judiciary, and we'll see how the confirmation hearings go and what that looks like.
I just happened to be thinking of Congress when I said highly unfavorable at this point.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, I mean, it's an unfavorable outcome or a favorable outcome. And as we said a few weeks ago, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, that redefined the conversation in terms of the election. It was no longer about COVID. It was about the Supreme Court nomination. And that's proven to be pretty accurate. What you're saying is Congress. And yeah, this is actually encouraging to me because it says to me that there's Americans on both sides of the aisle who are engaged in thinking and not necessarily, just sort of siloed in their own political camp, right? Appreciate where we started the conversation today talking about a move towards tribalism. But in this respect, there's commonality. 17%, according to Gallup, approve of Congress's job. 80% disapprove of the job Congress is doing. That covers a lot of people. That covers every political stripe. It basically says that the vast majority of Americans look at Congress with disgust. And again, bipartisan disgust when it comes to congressional jobs, that's encouraging to me. That's really encouraging to me.
Why are we moving into November? Okay, from February on into November and now just finding out that the lockdown might be more damaging than actually the disease.
Well,
the virus, the COVID, the C-19, the what Trump calls the China virus.
Yeah. In the last week, two significant things have happened there. And of course, this has to do with economics and people's experience of overall well-being, whether it's mental well-being, economic well-being, not just from a health standpoint, but to rule in on this, to weigh in on it, it does take health practitioners, epidemiologists, et cetera, et cetera. So we now have the WHO, World Health Organization, joining into the conversation, along with 1,700 doctors, epidemiologists, and research scientists pleading with politicians to manage COVID more intelligently.
A little like you talked about a couple of weeks ago, where you find the high-risk groups and do something about it, but the low-risk groups allow them to earn a living.
Yeah, it can't be on the basis of a one-size-fits-all economic lockdown. So it's age-specific. That's going to be tough for somebody who's, somewhere between the age of 60, 70, or above. I mean, they say that someone who's 80 years and above has 70 times the risk of a 40-year-old of dying. Okay, so where's the risk then? And we already talked about the CDC's statistics where you've got about a 5% rate of mortality if you're 70 years or older. Anything below that, and it drops below the single digits, down into like the fraction of a fraction of a percent. So does it make sense to be more targeted in defining the risk and in defining how you go about solving it?
So focused protection is what you're talking about. That's from the virus.
That's what the Great Barrington Declaration is about. 1,700 doctors signing on and saying it has to be age-specific and risk-specific categories. And that's how they define it, is focused protection. And the way they start the Barrington Declaration is something like this. As infectious disease epidemiologists, as public health scientists, we have grave concerns about the damaging physical and mental health impacts of the prevailing COVID-19 policies and recommend an approach we call focused protection. The bottom line is that it's risk-based and age-based. And
this goes back to that 71 million that you were talking about that were pushed into extreme poverty because of the lockdowns.
Yeah, so we have the unintended consequences of people who are not experiencing the same life that we are in the first world, right? So if we want to transition towards a virtual classroom, we can do that.
Not everybody can Zoom
at home.
Yeah, not everybody has the ability to Zoom.
Yeah, because we don't all live in the first world. So it gets to the heart of our conversation a few weeks ago. 71 million people globally pushed into extreme poverty, below $1.90 a day, by the lockdown measures. That was Financial Times several weeks ago. Last week, the Financial Times reports 270 million school-aged children in India damaged by lockdown measures. And I'm like, look, there's a carve-out. Of course, you've got private, educated, and top government schools in India. Doesn't matter at all. They easily adapt to a virtual classroom, with the only impact being lots of screen time. But that's not so for nearly 270 million underprivileged children in India.
Well, and even businesses, there's not an equal distribution of who's been affected. You know, the small businessman right now, the guy who really, he can't take the boards out of his windows at this point because he has rules and regulations that keep him from doing business.
How do we care? And who do we care about? I mean, these are critical questions as we figure out the proper policy measures and how to get them implemented. How do we care in such a way that there's not negative unintended consequences? Can we universalize our cure for everyone else? And I'm not talking about a vaccine. I'm just talking about the policy measures. And, you know, yeah, I think you can. You can define, coming back to politics, you can define the small business person as being squeezed by lockdown. And are they potentially another critical swing voter? You take away someone's livelihood in sort of the de Blasio or Cuomo style. And I think you're going to find a bunch of really angry people waiting to express their views at the ballot box. And why wait for the ballot box? Why be silent until then? Because look at the way we've created a social construct. If you express Trump support in any way, you are de facto a racist in the current environment. So what kind of energy do you want to spend in being a Trump supporter if you were a Trump supporter? None at all on the public field. So what do you end up with? You've got a loud voice on one side of the aisle, and you've got a silent voice on the other. Except, of course, if you're looking at sort of the numbers of people that show up at various rallies.
And the peaceful and riot. Right.
Well, I mean, you can see there's a lot of enthusiasm in terms of the number of people that show up for a Trump rally.
You know, we've been talking about waves and monetary wave. We talked about what looks to be an artificial blue wave. But it's been predicted since spring of last year, that we're going to have a second wave of infections that come up because winter's coming. And you just wonder if there's going to be a different political response at this time.
Yeah, so there's an ebb and flow, right? When you think of waves, actual real ones, waves and tides, there's the tide coming in, the tide going out. We had the first major issue with COVID, and it's receded. And actually, economic activity has improved. The employment numbers have improved. We're not anywhere back to 2019 numbers and might not be for many years to come. But you can see a second wave of infections already in motion in Europe and in select states here in the United States. And, you know, of course, there's a difference in conversation. Politicians can't bear to talk about morbidity and death rates, which, you know, we mentioned the CDC numbers. Death rates have been pretty stable. And as a percentage of cases, declining. And
but
we're talking about
infection rates get more airtime. I mean, they get more play because if you do have an agenda, you've got to have high rates of something.
Well, even if your agenda is the news media is just to sell advertising space, there's more drama involved because the numbers keep on getting bigger. So drama relating to infection rates, policy prescriptions, I think they're going to be driven off of those fears. And there's no doubt that, you know, Democrats are more risk averse on this issue. There's no doubt that economic closure is an easier course to take for those of a philosophical bent that minimizes the importance of commerce and free enterprise and prioritizes governmental interventionism. What I find very disingenuous about a lot of Republicans is that they've got this view that they're the non-interventionists and the Democrats are the interventionists. And yet when it comes to monetary policy, whether it's Donald Trump or any of his supporters, guess what you end up with? we've had the most radical forms of monetary interventionism in modern history, and there's no critique of it because circumstantially it's justified, right?
It's almost like they're competing to do it. It's almost like they think that that's what we're calling for.
Right. So, I mean, there is some philosophical differences in terms of who comes up with the answers, free enterprise system, an entrepreneurial spirit, or sort of a top-down governmental interventionism, almost dreams of being President Xi. But again, this raises the issues not of the difference between Republicans and Democrats, but between we, the citizens, us, if you will, and them, broadly categorizing them as the rulers. I have a hard time seeing a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and Democrats. Citizens have been forced through COVID to see every version, whether the color is important to you or not, every version of elitism. And I think this is, again, where differentiation has been lacking in the political sphere, with the net effect being the only real differentiation is between the average voter, the average man and woman, American citizen, and the average politician, who is clearly in a different class.
So this brings me back to what we've been talking about actually for years, but just the last few weeks again. What is the impact on the dollar? That's how we save energy. That's how we transact. And, you know, so what we're really talking about, blue wave, no blue wave. Maybe it's a red wave. Who knows? I mean, we haven't even looked at that side of things. But it is a Fed wave, and everyone is relying on the Fed wave. And you've brought up in the past zombification. A few weeks ago, you talked about the zombification of companies that really should have been allowed to fail. That's step one. Step two is devaluation. The more money you print, the less it's worth. You know, I mean, that's just obvious throughout history. The third step would be repression, keeping those interest rates low artificially as long as possible. That fourth step keeps coming back to me. Carmen Reinhart, the chief economist of the World Bank, she said a captive audience, getting caught as a captive audience. So it seems to me like we want to continue on this program. We can talk politics all we want. We can't control the outcome like the press thinks. But the Fed wave is going to do those four things ultimately to the dollar.
You know, this sometimes a surprise in conversation. And Sunday night, there was one of those surprises, family dinner, and we're settled in, just having a great time. And the topic of conversation comes to heaven and eternity.
Hmm. And that's a good conversation, actually.
So my 9-year-old daughter says, my great fear with living forever would be that I get bit by a zombie and I live forever in a state where I'm neither alive nor dead.
She has zombies on the mind, you know, Dave. We've talked about this the last
crazy.
Few weeks. Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, it was a surprising conversation. And I think the surprise for us today, if we're talking about waves, in the end, we've got the Fed wave continuing to carry all boats higher. There is a singular loser in that, and it's the dollar. So yeah. Maybe we call this not the blue wave, but the green wave, because that is our currency color, and at least for the time being, until we come up with some other monopoly alternative. But the cost of security, we've learned from history, the cost of security is freedom. And what we're learning in terms of the market is that the cost of predictability is in the currency. It's in the stability of our currency. So whether it's a blue wave or an orange wave, it's still the Fed tsunami I worry about most.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. And you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.